This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Scott Turow to the show. He is a number one New York Times bestselling author and partner at the international law firm Dentons. His legal thrillers have been translated into more than 40 languages, sold over 30 million copies, and made into Hollywood blockbusters. So really excited to have him on the show. He was a former U.S. assistant attorney in Chicago, where he prosecuted several high-profile corruption cases, including the tax fraud case of State Attorney General William Scott. Turow also was a lead counsel in Operation Greylord, the federal prosecution of Illinois judicial corruption cases. He's a former president of the Authors Guild, and his most famous book titles are Presumed Innocent, Innocent, Ultimate Punishment, A Lawyer's Reflections on Dealing with the Death Penalty, Reversible Errors, Identical, Testimony, and the new book, The Last Trial. Scott, it's great to have you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jason. Thanks. It's pub day today. So I woke up to a really glorious review in the New York Times, which is, of course, for all authors, a rare event.
Yes. Congratulations.
So I'm feeling celebratory. Thank you.
That's great. Congratulations to you. So there's a lot going on in the world nowadays, and you've certainly been around the legal industry, and then you've written a lot about the law and so forth, which is a very fascinating topic. It's the foundation of civilization. It really is. Without rule of law, we're all barbarians. You know. So where would you like to start? Do you want to talk about The Last Trial?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm proud of the book. And Sandy Stern, who's the central figure in The Last Trial, was Rusty Savage's defense lawyer in Presumed Innocent. And he's sort of been the first citizen of my fictional world and has appeared usually as a minor character in almost every novel since then. So he was center stage in my second novel, The Burden of Proof. And now, literally 30 years later, he's back taking his last bow. He's defending a lifelong friend, Kirill Pafko, a famous cancer researcher who's won the Nobel Prize, but now has been accused of fraud and insider trading and even murder because he won approval of a significantly successful anti-cancer medication without disclosing its lethal side effects. So he's on trial, and Stern is dealing with all of the many consequences that come from being at the last roundup, as it were, as last time in court. His defense of a medication which ironically has saved his life, and an old friend who he's never really felt he knew at the core, and as the trial progresses, he understands why.
Very interesting. Well, when we talk about the world of pharma, there's a lot going on nowadays with COVID. Yeah. There's this documentary that's been making the rounds, more conspiratorial, and it's been taken down from YouTube and Facebook, and it's called Plandemic. and it's a, you know, there are these patent wars, and it's just, it's really hard to know who's the good guy and who's the bad guy anymore. The world has become so complicated. You know, everybody's got an agenda, from Bill Gates to Trump to, you know, to, of course, everybody has an agenda, right?
Right.
How do we know what to make of this? You know, and Fauci, and there's just so much to it, you know?
I mean, people have accused me of anticipating all of this because The Last Trial gives you a pretty extensive view of the pharmaceutical testing process. And it doesn't answer any of the questions you just asked. It doesn't identify good guys or bad guys, but it does pose a lot of the questions that are frankly front and center these days. And for example, G-Livia, which is the drug that Kirill Pafko, Stern's client in the last trial, has patented and brought to market, is a very successful anti-cancer medication. But what he neglected to disclose, according to the government, is that it also kills a certain number of people after a year's use. And so you have what is really at the heart of our drug approval system, which is the moral dilemma. Is it okay to save the lives of a large number of people, right, knowing that you are also going to kill a smaller portion, right, of people?
It's the Karl Marx dilemma. You know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, right?
Well, you know, it's the basic Benthamite calculation. Yeah. But how scrupulous should the FDA be? Their argument is, if we had known about this, we could minimize the number of deaths that are occurring due to taking this medication. And frankly, that's a winning argument. There's no disputing that. And that's why the fraud charges are well-founded. But on the other hand, how do you take a medication that actually helps a number of cancer patients, including, most ironically, the defense lawyer himself, Sandy Stern, who has been a cancer sufferer and was last time he showed up in my novels a decade ago. How do you take that off the market? And then, wholly aside from that nest of issues, I ended up with some sympathy for the pharmaceutical manufacturers, which, candidly, I didn't go into this process. I went into this research with none. Mm-hmm. And it is true, because of the system that we have in the United States, that pharmaceutical manufacturers have to spend a boatload of money, often much of it wasted, in order to get one successful medication on the market. So when they get that drug, they price the hell out of it and make all of us pay for it. Now, they are prisoners of the system, just like the rest of us.
Right.
But one of the things that goes by in passing in the last trial is the question of whether we could design a better system,
right,
one in which the government took over the testing of pharmaceuticals so that the drug companies didn't have to pay for it, or face the temptation of squeezing the results to sort of conform to their wishes.
Yeah, and then there's the patent system and the way that works and the length of those patents. Of course, you've got to incentivize R&D, and you won't do that without protecting intellectual property, but it gets really murky after that idea, you know, which is a good idea.
One of the things I discovered, I had no idea that this was true, but up until like the late 70s or the early 80s, the government was doing a lot of this research on its own and then offering the patents. And they found that manufacturers wouldn't pick up the patent unless they got the exclusive right to make that drug. So a system in which sounds like it's in the public interest, where the government does the research and makes the patent available to everybody, that didn't work because the manufacturer said, we don't want to spend the money marketing a drug that the guy across the street will then be able to make as well and ride free on, you know, the money I've spent marketing it.
Right.
So that patent system you're talking about is actually the creature of a lot of good intentions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the concept is good, but it gets murky in practice for sure. It's interesting because Milton Friedman wrote a lot about the FDA and the way that works, and he made some really salient points, because one part of it that we never see is that you can't hear the dogs that don't bark. We never evaluate as humans in any part of life, it seems, what never happened. And what never happened is sometimes the most significant thing of all, you know? And so when you have a disease that affects, or an ailment of any kind that affects maybe a very small number of people, there's no incentive to do much about that because, you know, if the FDA bureaucrat takes the risk of approving the drug, you know, their career's right on the line. But, you know, if people die because they didn't approve it, nobody really complains terribly much about that, right? They complain right. if people die that they did approve. So it's
except
tough.
For the loved ones.
Sure.
I don't generally adhere to what Friedman said, you know. For example, he didn't generally believe in insider trading laws, or he thinks that, you know, the market will take care of all of that.
Right.
I always waited after the Great Recession in 2008 for all these free market economists who publicly proclaimed their mea culpas, because if you really think the market works faultlessly, then look what happened with the subprime mortgage market. So I'm not a fan of Friedmanian thinking, but
what all those libertarians will argue, though, is they'll say, well, we only got here because we had these government-sponsored entities like Fannie and Freddie that, you know, shouldn't be in the mortgage market anyway, right? So, you know, it's really murky. It's hard. But,
that is what they argue, yeah, and it's a legitimate argument. Yeah. It's legitimate. It's just that I don't think – I think, frankly – the mixture of public and private can often be lethal, and it has proven to be time and time again. And a drug approval system is just one of those.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that you can allow people, and we've seen a little of this, by the way, recently with the antibody tests mm-hmm. for COVID-19. You can't just have the FDA saying, oh, go ahead, put it out there, and then people say, take the antibody test. They go, oh, I had COVID-19. I didn't even know that. And then they hug and kiss everybody they meet. And right. lo and behold, they're in the hospital 2 weeks later. Yeah. So Americans don't like complication, right. generally speaking,
yep.
in their policy issues. And yet that's what makes novels, I think, really good, which is not technical detail, but morally complex subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the drug approval process is one of them.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, you've got so much experience in the legal world. Talk to us about what's going on at the Supreme Court today. This is a pretty interesting
yeah.
case, right? And are,
yeah.
and by the way, are they meeting virtually?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. They're doing it. Interestingly, they're doing it by teleconference. Mm-hmm. Apparently, in one of their maiden voyages with teleconference right. last week, one of the justices went to the bathroom and forgot to mute his phone. So
that's all on the record.
Yeah. So as a group of older people, they are proving as technologically inept as right. the rest of us.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Assuming that somebody has now figured out how to use the mute button,
mm-hmm.
What is before the court today is, I think, one of the more significant cases they've taken up this year, which is four congressional committees and separately the district attorney for Manhattan have subpoenaed many of Donald Trump's financial records from his bank and from his accountant. And included, of course, are the tax returns that Mr. Trump has repeatedly refused to disclose. And what's shocking to me about this case is, as you mentioned, I was an assistant U.S. attorney in Chicago for 8 years. I've practiced as a part of the criminal defense bar for the last 30. And the law has always put tremendous weight on who's holding the records.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a third person, as the accountants and the bankers are, you as a potential criminal defendant, as a target of a grand jury investigation, have no rights. You cannot intervene. So I've been practicing criminal law since 1986. I have never seen anybody successfully oppose a subpoena for records in the hands of a third party. So, but here comes Donald Trump and he says, no, they can't have these records. The Congress doesn't have a legitimate legislative purpose in issuing these subpoenas. And you can't have every local prosecutor all over the U.S. issuing subpoenas that impact the president. Now, mind you, the president doesn't have to do anything in response to these subpoenas. It's not like Bill Clinton in the Paula Jones case where he had to sit for a deposition, which mm-hmm. ultimately proved fatal to his reputation and in some ways to his presidency.
That was the funniest deposition ever, with him with a Coke can there and you know him squirreling. What is the definition of is?
Yeah.
it's ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are members of the Supreme Court now, like Brett Kavanaugh, who was one of Starr's prosecutors, who now, with a straight face, having done all of that to Clinton, argues that, no, I don't think the president should have to respond to criminal process while he's president. But the issues here are, is the Supreme Court going to actually decide that they can tell Congress what is and isn't a legitimate legislative purpose for them? The Trump side is screaming it's all political. And of course it is. Mm-hmm. It is. But that's what our elected representatives are supposed to be engaged in, mm-hmm. is expressing the political will of the people who elected them. So saying it's political is almost, that's an oxymoron.
Right.
So that's one issue, one big issue. Will the Supreme Court actually stick its nose in the Congress's business and say yay or nay about a given subpoena? In which case, there will never be another congressional subpoena that is not litigated through the federal courts. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. And then, much more significantly to me, is the Vance case. The New York DA has made an extensive in-camera showing to the court about why he wants to subpoena these records. And one of the things that is mentioned publicly, of course, is Michael Cohen's sworn testimony before Congress, in which he impugned the president for filing false tax returns in connection with Stormy Daniels, and also perhaps false financial statements with the banks from whom he borrowed, both state and federal crimes. But complicating this is that if, for example, Mr. Trump filed false tax returns, not only he, but perhaps some of his business associates and even perhaps his accountants are also guilty of crimes. So what the president wants the Supreme Court to do is to say to Mr. Vance, who's made a scrupulous showing about why he's doing this investigation, not only can you not investigate the president and preserve evidence for the time that he's out of office, not only can you not do that, you can't investigate anybody with whom he's associated, who might also get prosecuted now. And that clearly sweeps way too far. And because of that, because the stakes politically are very high, and because the law to me seems so clear, we are going to know more clearly than we ever have before how politicized this court is.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they reject particularly Vance's subpoena, it will be a nakedly political decision. And it probably will harken back to Bush versus Gore as the most politically driven decision the court has made in a decade or two decades.
You know, everybody, including justices, have their bias, right? Do you think, you know, I'm curious, the Supreme Court is supposed to be non-political because the appointments are for life. Do you think, given that people are living so much longer than they used to when that rule was made, it should still be a lifetime appointment? Or I've often wondered, I kind of think maybe it should be like a 10-year appointment or something like that. You know, you got really old justices here and you've got to question their ability to do what they do, right?
Yeah. I mean, a number of things to say about that. One, if I could wave a magic wand and suddenly become a framer of the Constitution, mm-hmm. I would say a 20-year term gives people enough independence, or a 10-year term and one renewal, with renewal presumed unless there's a 2/3 vote in each house of the Congress to remove somebody from the court.
Yeah, that's so that, interesting. Yeah.
So that there's a long enough time span that they feel politically independent.
Right.
Remarkably, there are very few tales, though, of justices remaining on the court and seeming addled. I think Thurgood Marshall was not in particularly good shape.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the Supreme Court seems to be a case study. Mm-hmm. What maintaining a high level of intellectual activity seems to do to forestall dementia.
Right, right.
Because you have all these 80-year-olds mm-hmm. 80-year-old plus, sitting on the court.
We're pretty sharp.
And when whether you agree with Scalia or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, there is no way around the fact that they had and have all their marbles. And that's a great thing in itself. So
I agree. It's definitely a study in that. And I think maybe more doctors should be studying the Supreme Court justices. That's a good point. The legal industry in general, the coronavirus crisis has created a lot of, I talk about Joseph Schumpeter as one of my favorite economists, because he talked about creative destruction. And we are seeing a lot of creative destruction. It's really moved that forward. And one of the most primitive industries in our country has got to be the legal system. It's just a really old-fashioned, unwilling to adopt technology type of industry, but it seems to be modernizing out of necessity with appearances via teleconference and so forth. And I think this is great. What do you think, and what do you see coming for the legal industry in the wake of COVID-19?
You know, it's odd that you say this, Jason, because in point of fact, the law has been radically transformed by technological developments, for good and for ill. For example, the invention of the word processor, making it so much easier to write, has led to a gigantic multiplication in the number of legal opinions, to the extent that a lot of appellate courts now refuse to let their written opinions actually be published, meaning that they can't be cited in subsequent cases. I think that, by the way, is baloney. Mm-hmm. If a court says something, our whole common law system depends on being able to use that case as the basis for a subsequent legal argument.
Wouldn't the appellate justice want to be cited? It seems like they'd want the credit for that.
They want to be able to get rid of cases.
Oh, dispose of them quickly, right? Yeah.
And say things that they don't want hung around their necks later on. But the point is that, you know, this didn't exist 30 years ago when I came into the practice of law. So other ways that the law has been hugely influenced by technological change is electronic discovery.
Right. E-discovery. That's big.
Again, though, it multiplies the problems. Instead of having to look through hundreds, even thousands of documents in a case, it's now hundreds of thousands. And every chief executive that I've ever represented has sadly learned that if you want to say something that might prove embarrassing, don't say it by email. So, but here is what I think is going to become a cutting edge question, which is that the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution guarantees criminal defendants the right to confront their accusers. Mm-hmm. That's what it says. Yep. And that's always been understood to mean that you have to do that face-to-face. Mm-hmm. You know, as happens in the last trial where Kirill Pafko's son ends up testifying against him, and the defense lawyer, Sandy Stern, and his daughter, Marta, end up using to great advantage the fact that this is a personal confrontation. And near the end of the cross-examination, Marta gets Kirill, the defendant, to stand up so that he's at his son's eye level. Mm-hmm. And he can literally make his son look his father in the eye as he testifies against him. So the Constitution says every defendant has to have the right to do that.
To face the accuser.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the question is, if that's happening electronically, does that satisfy the constitutional requirement? I doubt that the Supreme Court is going to say it does, which means that criminal trials, at least, are going to have to be live events. Whether you can do it in a civil case so that the jury is seeing everybody on Zoom or Skype or WebEx or whatever.
It seems like it might be impossible to do it with a jury, but with a bench trial, you can do it, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the jury part. If that just doesn't work electronically, I don't think.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But the idea that for these little hearings and pretrial motions and so forth, that the attorneys don't have to appear, I mean, that'll make the system a lot more efficient and less costly for the clients. So I think that's great news. And depositions, same thing. You know, this is stuff, this is not new technology. You know, we've had this, we could do this 20 years ago, but finally the legal system is just catching on.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, and if this proves your point, I think one of the most extraordinarily wasteful things that I witness regularly is sitting in a courtroom, mm-hmm. a crowded courtroom waiting. Where a judge is holding yeah. status calls, and people complain about the costs of, you know, legal representation, rightly. But that judge never thinks about the thousands and thousands of dollars that are being wasted by having those lawyers just sit there.
Yeah, and so and many of these courts have these absolutely stupid rules that sitting there waiting, you can't use your electronic device.
Right.
I mean, don't you dare
take your phone out or your iPad.
Oh, right. Yeah, they'll yell at right. you. Yeah.
Right. Stupid. So, because that means not everybody is not paying attention to the most important person in the room, the judge.
That's just ridiculous.
So, I mean, a system in which you've got a status call on Friday and you've got to be available between the hours of 9 and noon, and don't you dare get up from your chair right. and miss the call, is a much better system than forcing everybody to sit in the courtroom and do that. And so you and I can both hope that this the situation we've been in is one that leads people more toward that system.
Yeah. Any other things you see we got to wrap it up, but any other changes you see in the legal system coming out of this?
I think one thing I see is a lot of constitutional challenges. We're going to find out how far this can go within the meaning of our federal and state constitutions. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a lot of litigation about how much the various rights that we've always had mean being able to stand before a judge in person and plead your case.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, one of the things I saw right away when these quarantines started is one of the fundamental thing is the First Amendment and the right to peaceably assemble. Well, you can't assemble. I mean, and I don't mind, you know, the government doing what they did for a month or so. But after that, I kind of think, you know, you got to start questioning.
But that's like the drug issues that are at the heart of the last trial. You know, if people want to worship together or people want to protest together.
Yeah, if you want to have a rally, you know, you can't do it.
Can they be prohibited from doing it, bearing in mind that they are creating a risk to the health of large communities? Yeah. One of the things nobody has written about is that if you look at April 23rd and 24th, which were 10 to 11 days after Easter, there was a huge spike across the country in reported COVID infections. Mm. I don't think that's accidental. Mm. I think some people went to church, many people gathered with their families, yeah. and as a result, they got sick. Yeah. So the proof is there, but the question is, does the Constitution prohibit those activities, you know, the worship, the assembly. Yeah. And I, you know, that's a toughie.
These are tough issues.
People got sick in Wisconsin demonstrably by going to vote because the Democratic governor's wish to put off the election was overruled by the Republican legislature. And as a result, people got sick. And yet, can we really allow elections to be postponed? When they're the fundament, they're the basic thing in our society, I would say you can't. Mm-hmm. You can't.
Yeah. Another interesting one is, you know, and I don't really like the guy a lot of times, but Elon Musk, and, you know, he wants to be arrested now for opening his plant. That's going to be an interesting case. And I have a feeling he's going to win that. If they do arrest him, and I just think there'll be so much backlash against the government, but I don't know. It could go the other way, you know?
I don't know how his assembly line is set up. If the workers are literally distant from each other.
It seems like that could work okay, you know? It doesn't seem like it'd be a high-risk environment.
If it's a meat processing plant
that's different.
Where everybody is shoulder to shoulder and they're all handling the same things within, you know, instance of each other, that might be a problem. And then, you know, then you've got the other side of the coin, which is because of the steps they took, maybe because of the weather, California's been a far lower risk environment than, you know, my hometown of Chicago. Yeah. So all of these questions become very complicated. Yeah.
And they will become, the answers will become apparent in the years to come, in the months and years ahead. Scott, it's been fascinating talking with you. Give out your website. Of course, the books are available in all the usual places, but do you have a website you want to share?
I do, scottturow.com, and there's three T's in a row there. No dots or dashes, just scottturow.com. Thanks.
Excellent. Scott Turow, thanks for joining us.
Jason, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.